Thanks to the organizers for inviting me and allowing me to give this talk. If I can get it to turn on. So I'm gonna talk about not five halves, because I'm a firm believer that there's other interesting physics in the quantum Hall regime. Sorry? Yeah, absolutely. Especially you. Yeah, I'm gonna talk about work that's gone on in my lab for quite some time, and I'll focus on our newer results. But as I say, we've been working on this topic for, I don't know, longer than I care to remember. And there's a large number of people, these are all graduate students and one postdoc who've been involved, and most of the work that I'm gonna talk about today is that of Alex Champagne, who's recently left Caltech and is now a professor at Concordia University. And our samples also were grown by Lauren Pfeiffer, who is in an interesting Schrödinger cat state somewhere between these two institutions. And the work, as you can see, was funded by NSF and the Department of Energy. So I'm not gonna review this subject very much because it is an old one. So I'm only gonna say a couple of things at the beginning just to put the framework on. There is a quantum Hall effect in bilayer systems when the total filling factor is equal to one, and that's equivalent to thinking of the two layers as each having filling factor 1/2. This only occurs when the layers are sufficiently close together. And you can think of, well, if you make many such samples and you change the spacing between the layers and the amount of tunneling through the layers, through the barrier, you can create a sort of phenomenological phase diagram. Red samples are samples which do show this quantum Hall effect, and blue ones are ones that do not. So the green line is some kind of phase line that separates the no quantum Hall effect states from the quantum Hall effect states. And what I'm doing is I'm plotting against layer separation and tunneling strength. And since you can change both the thickness and the height of this barrier that separates the two layers, these two variables are essentially independent of one another, in principle at least. The work that I'm gonna talk about today is almost entirely focused, in fact, it is entirely focused, essentially on the vertical axis over here where the tunneling strength is not zero, but it's extraordinarily small. It's maybe a million times smaller than the mean Coulomb energy. So we're always working in that limit. Some of the stuff, perhaps that Vittorio will talk about, will be out here a little bit where there is, in fact, a significant amount of tunneling. So, you know, again, just to be very brief about it, in the simplest way of thinking of this system, if the tunneling is strong, you can easily understand the existence of a filling factor one quantum Hall state because the electrons simply occupy a symmetric linear combination of the two individual layer states. And this is, if the tunneling is really strong, it's nothing more than the ordinary integer quantized Hall effect. On the other hand, if the layer separation is small and the tunnel barrier is extraordinarily high, so that the tunnel splitting is really, really small, then there's yet a different reason or another reason to stabilize an incompressible state at filling factor one, and that's through a correlated state in which the electrons in the individual layers are correlated not only with their neighbors in the same layer, but also with the electrons in the other layer, because the layers are close together. And there's this famous wave function, which is a member of a class of wave functions that Burt wrote down long ago for multi-component systems, in which you not only you can see the correlations within the individual layers, but you also have an interlayer correlating term, which is of the same magnitude. And there are various ways that you can describe this state. I'm not gonna say anything more about this than to put this pretty picture up. Probably most of you know there's a pseudo-ferromagnetism picture, sort of an XY ferromagnetism picture, that you can use to describe this ground state that's very useful for describing certain experimental results. There are other ways of describing the state that are equivalent. One that I like is to think of it instead of as a magnet, to think of it as a Bose condensate of excitons, in which you take one of these two partially filled Landau levels and make a particle hole transformation on it, and think instead about a binding of electrons and holes. It's not a different language, it's a different language, but it's talking about the same subject. There's nothing different really there. So the quantum Hall effect was the first thing that we discovered in this system, and that's an interesting effect, but it doesn't tell you much about the internal physics of the action itself. It just says there's an energy gap and there's quantized Hall plateau, which is the same as all other quantum Hall effects. But other observables that you can look at, and in particular observables which are anti-symmetric in that layered index of freedom, things that take electrons in essence from one layer to the other, would be one example, like tunneling, show very spectacular responses that you're not familiar with from other quantum Hall states. It really distinguishes this state from all the others. Well, for example, in this picture, we have two tunneling spectra which are shown. A blue one where the layer separation has been adjusted to be too large to stabilize this state. And in that case, the tunneling near zero energy, you can see the blue trace, is very strongly suppressed. This is tunneling conductance. It's a very strong suppression. That's an interesting effect too. It's related to correlations in the individual layers. It's a Coulomb gap kind of phenomenon. And there it is. It's interesting. This also was discovered about the same time as the quantum Hall effect at filling factor one. But if you take the same sample and adjust its layer separation, or its effective dimensionless layer separation, to be smaller than this critical value, the tunneling spectrum just turns itself on its head. And instead of it being hard to tunnel between the two layers, it becomes extremely easy. It looks a little bit like a Josephson effect insofar as the conductance is almost a delta function here. Almost a delta function. I don't know what that phrase really means. But it becomes very, very tall and very, very thin. I'm sorry? It's literally the tunneling conductance. You have these two layers, and you have a battery, in essence, or an AC battery, and you're measuring DIdV between the two layers, perpendicular to the two layers, correct. It's not an edge tunneling. This is a bulk tunneling experiment. I didn't want to say much about this because I've got new results to talk about. So that's one of the dramatic phenomena that you see. Another one that's also anti-symmetric in the layer degree of freedom is to do transport, but unconventional transport, not to put the current in the same direction in the two layers, but to send it in opposite directions in the two layers. And you can do that because we have this way of making connections to the individual layers. So this is perfectly possible to do, even though it seems hard. Can be done. So you drive the current, let's say, from left to right in one layer and back from right to left in the other layer, and you measure the Hall effect and the longitudinal resistances, just like you would normally do. But when you reach the magnetic field for filling factor one in the bilayer system, you find an amazing thing. The Hall effect, which before you got to that magnetic field had exhibited the ordinary quantized Hall effect that you expect, suddenly makes a quantum Hall plateau, but it's at zero. The quantized Hall resistance falls all the way down to zero, or very, very close to zero. And at the same time, the longitudinal resistance also goes to zero. So this is extremely unusual, a transport phenomenon, very different than your ordinary quantum Hall effect. And it makes you think that the system is in a superfluid state rather than in an insulating state, which you normally would think, normally associate with Hall plateaus and vanishing longitudinal resistance. The fact that the Hall plateau is at zero makes a big difference. Okay. So those are the two sort of most signature phenomena, I would say, that are associated with this particular bilayer quantized Hall state. But what I want to focus on today is actually the nature of the phase transition. So think for the moment as a function of how far apart the layers are from one another, and you change them, and you see what happens. So this is a series of tunneling spectra, which Yagal is not a conductance anymore, and this is now IV curves. So differentiate these, you get the other set of data that I showed before. And each one of these traces is a different layer separation, which we managed to do by changing the density of the electron gas and then readjusting the magnetic field appropriately. And these traces which are in the back show the Coulomb gap that I talked about a minute ago, and that old blue trace where it's very, very flat and there's no conductance. But then as the layer separation is reduced, this is L over D, as the layer separation is reduced, this anomaly appears at zero bias and becomes very, very big. By the time you're at small layer separation, it's just gigantic. And this looks, and qualitatively, looks like a picture of the Josephson effect. But it's not, at least as far as we know. The slope of this thing that looks like a discontinuity is finite, even though it's very, very large. We don't know really how sharp that quasi-discontinuity becomes. What I want to talk about, though, today is the way this transition occurs. And you can see from this picture, the first thing that you would say is, well, it's pretty continuous. It just develops smoothly as a function of the layer separation. There doesn't appear to be any big jump in the tunneling conductance when you hit the phase transition. So that's the subject of the talk today. And what I've told you about so far is all confined to the one axis of this phase diagram, in which the layer separation is the only important variable. But in fact, there are many other variables that influence this phase transition. You could change the tunneling energy. I mentioned that at the very beginning. I'm not going to talk about that today. You could put on an in-plane magnetic field. There's more than one reason for doing that. I'm not going to talk about that today either. But these three things I will talk about. I'll talk about how to change what happens when you change the Zeeman energy, which ordinarily you would think of you would affect by changing the in-plane magnetic field, but that's not how we're going to do it. You can change the temperature, and you can change the amount of density in the two layers. So it turns out that in this 1-1-1 quantized Hall state, it actually doesn't matter how many electrons are in the individual layers. It matters how many electrons there are in total. The total number of electrons has to add up to filling factor one, not the individual layers. So in fact, the system is squishy with respect to the layer density imbalance. So this is an interesting variable, and it's, in fact, it'll be the one that I talk about the very most. Let's talk first, though, about what happens as a function of temperature. So the data that I showed you before, I didn't even give you the temperature, but it was pretty low. It was like 20 millikelvin or 25 millikelvin or so. And as we changed layer separation, we found that at some critical point, the tunneling conductance started to show the zero bias anomaly. Well, what happens if I raise the temperature? Is there a phase transition? So in theory, we have a quantum phase transition at zero temperature, and one believes in this model, for example, in this ferromagnetism model, that there's a Kosterlitz-Thouis transition which somehow goes up in temperature and is presumably connected to this point in the zero temperature limit. But one doesn't know that that's really what's happening in the experiment. So I'm going to talk about that. So here are two pictures, one in which we keep the temperature fixed and the other in which we keep the effective layer separation fixed. And I'm looking at the tunnel spectrum just around zero bias to see whether or not there is this interesting signature right at zero energy. And you can see that at low temperatures, I mean at fixed temperature, 55 millikelvin, as you increase or decrease the layer separation, right around 1.8, we start to pick up a small anomaly in the tunneling conductance at zero bias, and then it rapidly grows. So this has been multiplied by a factor of 100 relative to this one just to see it. So it grows very, very rapidly, and you see this peak develop. So that's sort of the same thing I've already shown you. But you can see exactly or qualitatively the same thing by holding the layer separation fixed, provided that it's small enough, and just increasing or decreasing, in this case, the temperature. If here at 160 millikelvin, you can barely pick something up. At 170, you would see nothing above the noise level. And then as you lower the temperature, the peak turns on. So these things look very much the same. So you can sort of imagine that there is some kind of line in temperature layer separation space, and you can go across that line in two different ways. So there's some kind of finite temperature transition there. If we take the tunneling strength at zero bias, just the height of that peak, and now plot it, notice this is a logarithmic axis, plot it versus the layer separation. At low, for depending on what temperature you're at, this is sort of the characteristic thing you see. It's actually a rather smooth transition, bearing in mind that this is logarithmic, but there's the drop-off of the tunneling conductance as the layer separation is increased. If I increase the temperature this way, I get the same basic curve. It just looks the same. It's just translated down to different layer separation. So it suggests that there you can look at this thing as either a temperature-dependent transition or a layer separation-dependent transition. It depends on what you would like to concentrate on, really. And there's no, at least no obvious smearing of this transition. Here we are at 250 millikelvin, five times higher temperature. And this curve still looks basically the same as this curve. It's not grossly smeared out. We've tried to quantify that, and this is not meant to be a scaling relationship. It's just an experimentalist way of drawing a smooth curve through some data. We take our tunneling conductance and fit it to a form like this. We imagine that there's some critical layer separation minus the actual layer separation raised to some exponent p. And we see whether that's what those fits are that I'm showing there. And if you look at the fit per... I'm sorry. Well, that's the point here of this graph, is that the results of that fit are that the exponent that I used turns out to be constant. It's about 3, and it just stays the same over all the data that we currently have. But the fitting of the, as Bert was asking, the critical layer separation, that's very strongly dependent. And that's just showing you the fact that these curves are just displacing themselves along. So at that level, I would say this is the phase transition line between the coherent bilayer at small layer separation and low temperatures and the incoherent bilayer at higher layer separation and higher temperature. So I would argue that this really is a finite temperature phase transition. What kind it is, of course, is a whole other matter. And I'll talk about that in just 1 second. I'm sorry. We're changing the magnetic length. It's always, I do this all in one sample, otherwise you'd be very, very difficult to be able to make nice data like this. Yes, we change the magnetic length and then adjust the density, then adjust the magnetic length appropriately so that we're at filling factor 1. Exactly. So let's talk for a second about this Kosterlitz-Thouis theory. Now, as far as I know, there is no theory curve for the the definitive one. Maybe Kuhn will throw something at me because maybe he did do something, I don't know. But there's no really definitive line that I could put on here. So I made one up. And the way I made it up was I went and I looked, I don't know anything about Kosterlitz-Thouis theory, really, but I looked up sort of basic idea that you have this superfluid stiffness And one can calculate, or at least in some approximation, one can calculate the superfluid stiffness, which is presumably proportional to the Coster-Lipschultz temperature. One can calculate it at zero temperature. So I took that zero temperature stiffness, and then I said, well, as a function of layer separation, for simplicity, I'm going to assume that the stiffness merely goes from some finite value to zero at a critical point, and I'm going to guess that it goes linearly. And if I do that and I put in that number, I get this dashed line. Okay, it's not a theory, it's just sort of, it's a quasi-theory. Correct, correct, that's exactly right. It's the d equals zero value. So the only things I put in are the d equals zero value and the zero temperature value of the stiffness, not the finite temperature value. Until you calculate that, I won't know what it is. Okay, so I'm not, by no means, I'm saying that this dashed line says that our solid line represents the discovery of the Coster-Lipschultz transition, but it's not ridiculously far off. No, the stiffness is a theoretical calculation. It's a theoretical calculation. That's right. And I probably adjusted them to fit here. So the only thing that's important, this is a good question. The only thing that's really worth comparing here is the slope of this line compared to the slope of that line, not the absolute magnitude. You're right. Okay. Okay. Okay, good. Now let me go away from temperature and talk about layer separation again for a moment. So the upshot of what I told you a minute ago was that we think there is a finite temperature transition, but we really don't. I'm not saying that it's the Coster-Lipschultz transition. It might be, but it might not be. It could be a first order transition, for example. So here, what I'm going to talk again about is layer separation, and the variable that I'm going to, the experimental observable I'm going to look at is Coulomb drag. So I'm going to put current in one layer and measure voltages in the other layer. And you can do that in a magnetic field either longitudinally or transverse. And so what do you see? This is an old result, at least initially. What you find is that the drag resistance in the Hall channel gets quantized at H over E squared. So when you go into this coherent phase, actually a voltage develops transverse in the layer that's not carrying any current, transverse to the current in the layer that is. That's exactly H over E squared times that current. So there it is. At the same time, the longitudinal drag, not too surprisingly, it's the blue curve, is vanishing. That's not surprising. There's a gap, you're at low temperatures, you expect the drag to vanish. The red curve is the ordinary resistance that you would measure in a normal quantum Hall, you know, Chubnikov-Haas type measurement. Okay, so that's the phenomenology that you see when the layer separation is small. But what about close to the phase transition? Because that's what I'm interested in here. Well, the blue curve shows the way in which the Hall component of the drag increases from zero, there is no Hall drag at large layer separation in the uncorrelated incoherent phase, it rises up, becomes this quantized value. And it does so over some transition region. At the same time, interestingly, we found that the drag in the longitudinal sense is very small at large layer separations, and it's very small at small layer separations. In the one case, you've got a gap. In the other case, you've got these two coherent, not incoherent, composite fermion states. We've also studied drag in that regime. It's small at low temperatures, but in the transition region, the longitudinal drag gets this big peak. So this peak is a very strong indicator that you're at the transition. And you know, you can look at the width and the position of that peak. And we even knew from the position that this linear dependence of the critical point on temperature was already there. We sort of already knew that, at least qualitatively. And the reason I bring this up is that there's a model, a sort of persuasive model, that Adi Stern and Bert Halpern worked out when this longitudinal drag peak was observed, in which they imagined that there was really a first order phase transition, and that the system near the critical point was breaking up into puddles, either of the incoherent fluid or of the coherent fluid. And those two fluids have very different resistivity tensors. In the composite fermion system, basically you have a big off-diagonal Hall resistance and some relatively small longitudinal resistance. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about currents going in the same direction or in opposite directions in the two layers, because they're uncorrelated. So those are the same. Whereas in the so-called superfluid state, or in the coherent phase, in the symmetric channel, the longitudinal resistance is again zero. The Hall resistance is quantized. But in the anti-symmetric channel, the resistivity is just zero on both longitudinal and transverse. And that difference really in the Hall part of the resistivity, when you have this inhomogeneous system, is what's responsible, in their view, for the existence of this peak. And in fact, they were even able to predict that at the peak, or basically in the vicinity of the peak, the maximum value of the drag should be given by h over 2e squared. Now, we don't find particularly good agreement with that, but at the factor of 2 level, we do. And I don't really know, we haven't tried super hard to try to find out whether that and something called a semicircle law that Adi's been pushing on me for years really works with our data. It does not seem to work so great, but at semi-quantitative level, things are in good shape. So this is a first-order phase transition picture. Yeah.
The model assumes that the uncorrelated phase is a
positive. Not really. You should ask these guys. It assumes these resistivity tensors. That's all it assumes. And that, I don't think that has anything to do with composite fermions. The Hall resistance will be basically 2H over E squared, and the longitudinal resistance is going to be small. No, I don't believe so. You should ask them, but I don't believe so. I think it's just a question of the resistivity tensor. Okay, so that's it for... So that gives you an indication that maybe there is a first-order transition going on here. So then we did another experiment. Actually, Ian Spielman did this, sort of the last experiment he did before he left to go off into the murky world of cold atoms. He did basically an experiment to modulate the Zeeman energy. And the way we modulate the Zeeman energy here is not to change, usually the conventional way, of course, is to change, put on an in-plane magnetic field, and that's fine too. But what we did was to alter the spin state of the nuclei. So the nuclei are coupled to the electron gas through the hyperfine interaction. And it's a remarkable fact that if you could polarize all of the gallium and the arsenic spins in the sample, the hyperfine interaction, the electrons would think there was an additional 5.3 Tesla of magnetic field applied to them. It's a huge effect. Now, of course, thermodynamically, at 30 millikelvin and 3 Tesla, you work out the nuclear spin polarization is nowhere near 100%. It's a few percent, but this still gives you a non-trivial magnetic field that is working on the spins of the electrons. And that can be basically incorporated into the Zeeman energy for the electron gas as an additional magnetic field B sub nuclear. And you notice I put a minus sign here. It's very interesting that it is in the opposite direction to the real magnetic field that you're applying. We can talk about why that is if you're interested. But the point is that if you fiddle with NMR, if you come with a coil around the sample and you zap it at the NMR frequency of one of these nuclei, you can destroy the nuclear polarization. You can knock those spins over, heat up the nuclei to infinity, and they have no polarization anymore. And what have you done? You've then changed the Zeeman energy for the electrons. And it's a very nice way of doing it, because it does not, by definition, it doesn't couple to the orbital degrees of freedom at all. So it's a very nice way to go about this. The important point is that if you destroy the nuclear polarization, because of that funny minus sign, you increase the Zeeman energy. So if you go then and say, well, what do you see? If you look at the peak in tunneling, you find, and let's just forget about this for now. Just look at this. If I look at that peak and I sit up on the top and I come with the NMR pulse and I knock over the 71 gallium nuclei, which is about one-third of the total number of spins that are in the system. You knock them over, the Zeeman energy has gone up by a little bit. The height of the tunneling peak increased. It jumped up by almost a factor of 2, and then it slowly, over some thousands of seconds, returned to equilibrium. And it was this thousands of seconds that told me we didn't do the NMR first, but we started seeing these thousand-second time constants. I knew that this had to be nuclear, because that's where you get long relaxation times. So somehow, what this experiment is telling you is very simple. It's saying, if I increase the Zeeman energy, I strengthen the coherent phase. The tunneling peak gets bigger. And in fact, if you go to the phase transition, go to the phase boundary, and you sit just above it, in equilibrium, the tunneling conductance has nothing but a Coulomb gap. I've blown things up by some orders of magnitude here, so it's real noisy looking. There's no resonance at zero bias. You're in the incoherent phase, and then all you do is knock over those nuclei, and boom, the peak is there. Okay, so the phase is there, and then you wait 20 minutes, and it's gone. So it's definitely related to the nuclear spin state and the degree of polarization of the system. So what is this telling you? It's telling you a very simple thing. It's telling you that it must be true that the spin polarization of the coherent phase is larger than the spin polarization of the incoherent phase. right? Because that's the only way you can explain the direction of this effect. Increasing the Zeeman energy stabilized the coherent phase. So it must have larger spin polarization than the incoherent phase. And at the same time, it's telling you that the phase transition is one in which the spin polarization changes. This, again, is a very strong indicator that the system is undergoing a first-order phase transition rather than a continuous one. This is actually, let's forget this part, it's not important. Now you may, I'll show this because Lisa put so much time into this ridiculous animation. So what's the picture? It's not even, only 5 minutes, I'm in big trouble. I won't do this. We'll do this some other day. Whoop, there it went. Okay. What I want to talk to you in the last 5 minutes is what happens if you sit just above the phase boundary and now you take charge and take it from one layer to the other. Keep the filling factor equal to one. Take epsilon worth of charge from one layer, put it in the other layer. What you find is if you're sitting right above the phase boundary and you do that, a little bit of charge transfer actually creates the coherent phase. So once again, you find a way to cross the phase boundary using this variable, a different variable than just layer separation. You're changing the imbalance, what we call the imbalance. So this was a relatively old result. We've done lots more on this. This is a very complicated picture. But the basic idea is here is that the horizontal axes of all three of these graphs is imbalance. In other words, the difference in the filling factor between the two layers. Every data point is at total filling factor one, but the difference in density is the thing that's the operative variable. And the vertical axis is always the strength of the tunneling peak. So if you're very deep, what we call deep in the phase, you find that there's a relatively gentle dependence upon layer imbalance. The tunneling does get weaker, but not extremely fast. I can't go out to arbitrarily large imbalances. We've been able to get out to around 1/4, 3/4 before the system starts to localize in the low density layer, and then we have problems. But look what happens as you approach the phase boundary. The layer separation is being increased, and you get to a point where, like what I just showed you a minute ago, the tunneling strength seems to rise with small amounts of imbalance. And in fact, if you get closer still, you find that there's an entire range of imbalances where there just isn't, as far as we can tell, there is no coherent phase whatsoever. And then by making like 20% of the huge imbalance, the state appears, meaning the peak in the tunnel just appears, but then it goes away again. So there's some reentrance, and the reentrant part we had not known about until relatively recently. Okay? All right. So we now, by doing lots of that, we've established that the phase diagram as a function of imbalance looks something like this. So these are different temperatures, and this is imbalance, and this is critical layer separation, as defined by where do you start to see the tunneling peak versus where do you not see it. And you see that the thing has this, you know, sort of camelback, although I was explained by the referee that camels have one hump, but that's false. Some camels have two humps. So I looked, you know, went onto Wikipedia and I found out about camels and I wrote back to the editors that I'm not changing that. Dromedaries and Bakhtiar, is that what it's called?
Bactrian.
Okay. All right, so apparently you're not the referee, Bert. So it's got this camelback shape, but notice something interesting. If you're at balance and you change the temperature, as I've already shown you, there's this linear dependence of the critical layer separation. But as you get out further, around 1/3, 2/3, then there's much less temperature dependence. And you can even begin to see a little bit of structure there. So I'm going to end up going over time by a couple minutes, but maybe you just bear with me for a second. I'm going to make a goofy model of how this all works, and you can throw stuff at me if you don't like it. So here's a picture of the total energy of a single layer of spinless electrons as a function of magnetic field. Well, it's a trivial thing to calculate. It's a bunch of inverted parabolas, but if you broaden out the Landau levels, you find out that you can see, maybe I've broadened them out so you can only see one cusp in the energy. At low magnetic fields, all these little parabolas add up into a parabolic increase in the total energy with magnetic field. This is called Landau diamagnetism. A very simple thing. Okay? That's a single layer of dirty electrons with no spin. So now I say, all right, that's exactly what composite fermions are. If I go to half-filled Landau level, I could imagine that the total energy of the incoherent state, mind you, of half-filled Landau levels would rise parabolically with effective magnetic field as I move away from filling factor 1/2 because of this diamagnetism. And then it would show some series of wiggles. In particular, it would a sample would have a cusp when you got to one-third filling, because that's the Landau level splitting for composite fermions. So this is not a radical idea at all. And if there were two layers, I'm simply going to say they're more or less identical. So I'm going to add them together. This point is half plus half. This point is now one-third plus two-thirds. There must be a downward cusp in the energy there. So what am I doing with my experiment? I'm bringing a coherent phase, which I will assume, because of the broken symmetry, is its energy is independent of how I shovel, which is not really true, but approximately true. It's certainly true at zero layer separation, that its energy is just independent of imbalance. And then I'm going to change the layer separation and destabilize this coherent phase. The first thing I do is I bring it up and it intersects this parabolic increase. This will directly explain why the phase boundary goes up parabolically with imbalance. It's really coming from the total energy of the composite fermion state when it's imbalanced. It's not coming from, I don't believe the proper way to think of this is in terms of magneto-roton minimums that are going soft. I think there's a much simpler way to understand why the phase boundary rises initially. But then you can see if you raise it too much in this simple picture, the coherent phase will only be lower in energy in certain regions. So you would expect reentrance. And then if you could make the system have so far away in D over L, the system would not ever prefer to be in the coherent state. It would only be in the independent layer systems. Maybe at extremely large imbalance, you might get a coherent phase, but I suspect the system will localize first before it would do that. So that's kind of flaky, but it's an idea. One conclusion from that idea is that you should have a transition, an interesting transition at this point, where you go directly from a coherent phase at filling factor 1 to two incoherent or interlayer correlated independent fractional quantum Hall states at 1/3 and 2/3. So can I see that? And the answer is yes. This really is an amazing graph, I think. So here we are sitting with the layer densities adjusted, so we have 1/3, 2/3 filling on average in the two layers, okay? And what I'm now doing is simply keeping that imbalance fixed, but gradually increasing the layer separation. And what you see is that the tunneling peak, which is this which I use as my indicator that the coherent phase is present, just goes boom. By 1.84, it's just gone, okay? That we've seen before. But what's new is that if you simultaneously look at the Hall resistance, you put the current in the way this measurement's done in the lower panel, the current's going in one layer, and we're measuring the Hall resistance in that layer. Now, a remarkable fact about the coherent phase is that when the coherent phase is present, you will always get H over E squared for that value of that resistance, independent of how the current is apportioned between the two layers. But if the system changes and becomes a 1/3, 2/3 state, then all of a sudden things will change quite dramatically. And you can see that as we change around filling factor 1, first we have a Hall plateau at H over E squared, and then in the same range where the coherent phase is collapsing, boom, Hall resistance goes up, and it's quantized again. This is for the layer that's at 2/3 filling. It goes up to 1.5 times H over E squared. So we make a pretty much almost, it seems a very, very rapid transition from an incompressible coherent phase to an incompressible incoherent phase. Okay. Do I have any time left? Actually, no. Okay, well then since I have no time left, I'll only say one more thing. This will take 1 minute. Yes, 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 that's the picture. And that there's no reason to suspect that state, when I see that Hall plateau go up to the 2/3 value, that it's in any way significantly interlayer correlated. I couldn't tell if it was weakly interlayer correlated, but it doesn't seem to be. So in this last negative 1 minute that I have, so this was the phase diagram that I showed at the very beginning, right? And this was always done with a finite amount of Zeeman energy around, and we learned that Zeeman energy was a relevant variable. So you really need to plot the phase diagram like this. Layer separation, this is, again, limiting the number of dimensions to the phase diagram, tunneling strength and Zeeman energy, and we were doing cuts out here somewhere all the time. So it raises the interesting question, is it if you could make a sample in which the Zeeman energy was much larger so that the incoherent half-filled lambda level was also spin polarized. That would be a different phase transition, or at least one that we've not yet examined. So I would argue that the phase boundary has to look something like this. There's a red line that says that as you increase from where we currently are with samples, as you increase the Zeeman energy, actually you increase the phase space for the coherent phase, and the composite fermion paramagnetic phase moves up, but then you'll reach a point, a triple point, really, where the composite fermion fluid will now be polarized. They'll both be polarized, so no longer anything will depend on Zeeman energy, and the line will go flat. And there should be some kind of vertical line or something like that here, which separates the paramagnetic from the polarized phase for the composite fermions. And lo and behold, this has been observed. So Muraki and his collaborators in Japan have done a very nice experiment where they just look at the depth of the quantum Hall state in rho XX. They don't look at tunneling or anything like that. They just say, when do I see the minimum? When don't I see the minimum? And they put on parallel magnetic fields. They don't do the NMR. The parallel magnetic field has the advantage that you can put on a much bigger change in the Zeeman energy than we're able to do. But you know, you worry about the orbital effects that it creates. And they found that it goes up just like we had observed. I'm sorry? Eta is the normalized strength of the Zeeman energy divided by the Coulomb energy. That's the usual parameter. So we had observed with NMR that this slope was positive, and we found essentially the same value that they get, but they were able to map it out much further. And there are hints in this data that it's beginning to saturate. I think, you know, it's unfortunate. The guy only had a 9 Tesla magnet. It's really too bad. If he had a bigger magnet, he could have walked out this curve and seen whether this was really flat. So we're going to do that. I'm sure he's going to do it too. So the evidence that I've shown you so far, and I'm really done now, is that this transition where we've done most of our work kind of looks first order. But I think it's an interesting question. What does this transition look like? Is that first order or not? And what I'm going to do, in the next few months, we're ready to do this experiment right now, is we can't do tunneling. I won't bother you why. But we're going to look at Coulomb drag and counterflow transport as we cross this phase boundary. We know what it looks like down here. We have no idea what it's going to look like up here. Maybe that anomaly in the Coulomb drag that Bert and Adi explained from phase separation doesn't show up. Or maybe it's different in some way. I don't know. That's where we're going with this stuff. Thanks a lot. Sorry I went over time.
So when we asked Jim to give a talk, we asked him to speak for 45 minutes a couple of months ago. He said he only needed 30 minutes. Apparently, he took a lot of data in the last couple of months.
If you'd given me 45 minutes, I would have talked for an hour.
That's also true.
Did I say that, really?
Yeah, I have many questions, but since you do not have 45 minutes, I'll ask just one. So when you are going, it's very interesting, right, this when you go imbalance, the state first goes away, and then you see other incompressible states. So it's a two-part question. First part is that if we just concentrate on your original interlayer coherent state, do you have a pretty idea that when you're going off balance just at the beginning, the state is more stable or less stable, or is that kind of impossible?
You mean initially?
Initially, right. Well, as you know, there is theoretical work on that.
Yeah.
Which predicts that it should go away.
I know, and it's yours. And what Shankar is asking about sort of reflected in that graph. And so you've got to be a little careful.
Right.
So the strength of the tunneling, as you can see with imbalance when we're deep in the phase, is indeed going down. Now, does that mean the stability of the phase is changing? I don't know. I'm not trying to conclude that. What I am arguing is when it just drops abruptly like this and like this on the other side, that to me suggests a phase transition rather than a smooth variation. As you well know, the simplest thing to say is the pseudo-spin order parameter is rising up out of the plane, mm-hmm. and you geometrically calculate its projection onto the plane. And if I should have put that on. I was thinking I didn't have time to write the view graph. It's in our paper, though. It's far away from this. This is much stronger than that.
Okay. And the second question related is that when you are going off balance now, not by infinitesimal amount, by large amount, there is a series of incompressible states.
Oh, absolutely.
For example, you know, 2/5, 3/5.
Oh, of course.
So if you go to low temperature, the kind of behavior you saw you'd see more and more of it.
That would be 2/5, 3/5.
Right. So it's just not going to be 1/3, 2/3 that you
emphasize. It's not just a matter of temperature. These samples are just too dirty.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
There should be a whole complicated thing. It's on.
I don't know if that's working, but just to mention, so you drew the blue curve as completely flat. Yeah. Obviously, it should have some curvature too, but the question is how much does it
curve?
I mean, would expect it to curve up, but perhaps less than the other.
Correct. So I didn't have time to talk about it, but
question that
Gil and one of his students and Adi and to a lesser extent me are trying to make this model a little more concrete. And I would have liked to have talked about this because you can actually extract from it some of the main parameters of these two different total energies from making this analysis. By combining the Zeeman slope to the imbalanced parabolic dependence, you can actually pull out the effective mass of the composite fermions, and you can pull out the coefficient, if you like, to a linear expansion of the total energy of the coherent phase near the phase boundary. And there, Gil tells me that, yes, they are including in the more proper way to do this, they're including some estimation of the thing you're exactly asking about.
Okay, well, maybe
one. So you mentioned that there is this exponent in G of zero. Is it? And it looks like it's constant.
Yeah.
Right? So is it related to some critical exponent in?
Right. So the answer is we don't know. I should have also said that, let me get back to it for a second here. I don't want you to interpret it that way. This was just a bunch of experimentalists sitting around trying to decide what curve looked like it went through the data. That was it. And the reason we did this analysis was to be able, as Bert asked, was to extract this. The critical layer separation versus temperature, and that's what came out to be linear. This is not meant to be some kind of fancy scaling relation that I can't justify. Now, furthermore, you don't need to use this function. You can use other functions to fit the data just as well. And in fact, we used a function that looks very Coster-Lizalis-like. We used, if this is really telling you, the fact that this exponent is pretty big, 3, is telling you that this tunneling conductance turns on very smoothly. With actually, even though it looks, the plotting in this logarithmic way kind of makes it look like it's sharp. It's actually really, really smooth. You saw that at the beginning. If you look at it in this sort of Coster-Lizalis way, you can fit this data just as well to a function which has got this, essential singularity at the critical transition that is smooth in all at all orders. And that'll fit the data pretty much just as well. And you can pick out from that a critical layer separation. And it's the same. It's actually shifted by a tiny little bit, but it's got the same linear slope as the one that we've established here. But I don't want to, I'm not trying to say that these functions have any sort of first principles justification.
Okay, I think time to thank Jim again. And move on to the second talk, Dr. Peregrini from Pisa.